The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. A masterclass from sloppy Liverpool against Arteta's brave boys. Is the title won already? Will Jota nick one of the front three places? Should Jurgen Klopp become a pundit? Are Fulham down already? Hammered at home by Villa? Is it useful for a club owner to tweet about signing new players before their current ones have got back to the dressing room? We'll do Germany with Archie, Spain with Sid, see if we can work out how to save the EFL and try to avoid talking about handball. Has Barry retrieved the Carabao Cup box? Will Jordan swear again? And is it totally unacceptable to appear on, you know, that podcast? All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Barry Glendenning, have you retrieved the Carabao Cup box?
No, I know where it is. It's in Guardian Towers in a locker, kind of a safety deposit box, really.
Right.
But I don't.
Is it the?
I don't have it to hand.
Is it the most valuable thing you own? Is that why you've locked it away?
It certainly seems to be the most popular thing I own.
Jordan Jarrett Bryan, how are you?
I'm fantastic, Max. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. I'm sure the last time we did a pod, you did a wonderful swear, a word that I don't often hear, and I can't remember who you were describing. It might have been Mike Dean. But anyway,
I'm genuinely confused. Sorry, before we go on further, what was the word I used?
It was PSG and... It begins with W, and I think it was the first time I'd heard that one on the pod.
Apologies for my foul language.
Like the commentator has to go, if you did hear some swearing, I'd like to apologise to everyone. A question from Jack. I see Rory Smith was on another popular football podcast yesterday. Does this make him a trialist for today's pod? Do you think he's good enough to tie down a long-term deal? Rory, welcome.
Thank you, Max. It's lovely to be here. How are you?
It's very nice to see you from the New York Times, Rory Smith. All I'll say is, welcome to the good guys.
It's an accident of timing. No, it's very kind of you to have me, especially, you know, given that there would have been some unpleasantness. But it's nice to be. I'm a bridge builder.
Yeah. Well, I just hope you have a nice time, Rory.
That's the key thing.
That's the key thing in life. Should we start at Anfield then? Liverpool 3, Arsenal 1. 3 wins from 3. First defeat for Arsenal. Liverpool, Rory, were brilliant, weren't they, last night?
Yeah, I actually thought Arsenal did really well, you know. I was there and I was kind of watching the game in front of me and then watching my Twitter timeline fill up with Arsenal fans bemoaning the state of their team. And I thought what Arsenal did kind of made sense. They limited Liverpool. They made Liverpool work quite hard for chances. They obviously took the lead, a bit of a slice of luck. But they kept themselves in the game. And then in the second half, with Lacazette, is a little bit more ruthless and clinical, then they nick a point or perhaps more. I thought it was a kind of a logical performance from Arsenal, with the main problem really being that Liverpool are really quite good and have hit the ground running. They look as well oiled as they did last season, and they just kind of have this ability not to be fazed or cowed by anything, which I think is pretty valuable.
Jordan, do you think Liverpool are just like fitter or a different set of human beings to everyone else? Just the way they swarm is just, it's quite unbelievable, really.
No, I don't. I just think, as Rory says, I think they're just a very, very good team that we're seeing the work come to fruition of 3 years of what Klopp's been working on in building a team that works hard, knows what they're doing, has very, very good attackers and has very, very good defenders. And I think if you have very good defenders who defend well, and you have the likes of Mane and Salah up front, you're going to win a lot of games with an ethic that I think goes for that team of, we're going to work harder than everybody else. And if you combine talent and work rate, it's not a surprise that they were as efficient as they were yesterday. I do think Arsenal did play quite well yesterday. My biggest frustration for Arsenal has been one, and there's been many lessons learned in this post-Wenger era, but one of the lessons that hasn't been learned, and it's a big annoyance of mine, is game management. Arsenal seem to concede so many goals at really horrible times, whether it's just before half-time, just before full-time, or just after they've scored. The frustration is you work hard to get that goal. The game plan was clearly dig in, be defensively solid, work really hard. They did that. You'll get a chance, be clinical. They took it. But then within 8 minutes, you're 2-1 down again. And that was a big annoyance for me as an Arsenal fan, and just watching as well, just seeing out that 5 minutes after they score. But I think the better team won. And I think Liverpool, as I predicted pre-season, will win the title this year because they've got a defence. I don't think any other team in the league has a defence.
Jordan, when would you most like Arsenal to concede goals?
Well, in an ideal world.
Yeah, when's the perfect time?
I mean, not 2 minutes after you score. Anything after that I can accept, but constantly scoring and then capitulating, maybe a bit strong, but conceding straight away is very annoying.
Just need someone to shout, next five, nothing silly, still nil-nil. I think Arsenal were brave, Barry, but I don't know, Liverpool just... I thought Sadio Mane, and maybe he should have been sent off. I don't know what you think about that, Baz, but like there was just... He was so up for this game. There was one turn he did, a sort of swivel and turn that I think would have taken me about an hour and a half, and I would have dislocated something. I thought he was brilliant last night.
Yeah, he was outstanding. I'm not quite sure why he seemed particularly motivated for that game. And with regard to the red, yellow, I'd go orange, and probably because it was quite early in the game, he got away with it. Maybe he wouldn't have later. Liverpool, sorry, this is a Mane specific question. It's not a surprise he's good. We know how good he is. With regard to Arsenal, there's no disgrace in losing to Liverpool when they play that well. They're at a much earlier stage of their development. They're still becoming accustomed to Mikel Arteta's blueprint. And there was one stage during the game, I think the ball came to Rob Holding, and you could tell with every fibre of his being, he wanted to hoof it the length of the pitch or as far away from as possible. But he elected not to because, you know, he knew he would get a bollocking if he didn't obey orders and play a short pass to someone, you know, just in front of him or beside him or back to the keeper. But yeah, Liverpool were superb. But if I was an Arsenal fan, I wouldn't be unhappy.
I don't know if this came through. Kind of the weirdest thing about the game last night was that Arsenal were really clearly determined to pass it about in their own 6 yard box. And it was as though they'd watched all of those videos that have gone round of the goals, the Arteta goal that they scored at. The attack that starts with David Luiz and the other central defender passing it around in the 6 yard box, and then they feed it out to a fullback, and then they work it through the thirds, as people say, and then into the forwards, and they score a goal, and it's the Arteta goal, and it's kind of, this is what he's doing, isn't he a great manager? All of which is true. Arteta is the work he's done there in 8 months is amazing, and he deserves immense credit. But what was really weird last night was that they pass it about, and you get like Leno to Luiz, Luiz to Holding, Holding to Leno, Holding to Luiz, Tierney, Luiz, and then one of them would just blast it forward. And like the first couple of times you think, all right, so to an extent, it kind of makes sense that you obviously want to draw Liverpool's press. You do it two or three times, work out that it's not working, you're just blasting the ball forward above, you know, Lacazette and Aubameyang's heads and giving it away. Maybe stop doing it, but they just kept doing it. And I think there is a point where you have to kind of like think, all right, maybe this plan that we've got is maybe Liverpool have got wise to this plan of ours and we need to have a second plan.
What is the second plan? Just to launch it straight away?
Just launch it early doors. Just catch them by surprise. Fake to mess about with it on the 6 yard box and almost give it away. And then just get Bernd Leno to smash it down the pitch. And I don't know. I think that goal kicks are really interesting now because everyone is trying to draw the press. And if you actually look at the way the pitch is set, I mean, I don't want to come over on Michael Cox, but...
No, nobody does.
No one does. That's a horrendous idea in lots of ways. But if you look at the way pitches are set up, I'm going to give up. Sorry.
Sorry, everybody. Jordan, though, like as an Arsenal fan, I was getting butterflies the way Arsenal were trying to play it out from the back there. And I presume you were, or were you fully behind it? And you have to be brave when you play Liverpool, right?
I think you do. I think in some senses, the best way to play Liverpool is to almost give them the ball from within their half, because up until the Arsenal goal, and indeed the Liverpool equaliser, they were jabbing, but they weren't really causing Arsenal that many obvious problems. I think that what you don't want to do is get caught with the ball on your six-yard box, because Liverpool are the best at pressing back and winning it and scoring a goal. I think in other games, I'm happy for Arsenal to be playing out from the back, because I think we've seen in spurts and certain goals, it's worked. The goal against Liverpool in the Community Shield is an example. The goal against Fulham is an example of where they've started very low back from passing and worked their way up the pitch and scored. And I think invariably, Arteta's hoping, as we've seen with Pep and his teams, that if you're brave, you will score more than you mess up. And over time, hoping that brings its rewards. But no, it's a little bit heart in mouth at times. But I'm behind it. I'm cool with it.
What did you make, Baz, Diogo Jota's debut. It seemed to me that Arsenal didn't know he played for Liverpool, so every time he got it, he was clean through.
Yeah, I'd kind of forgotten he'd signed for them as well. Yeah, it was a very impressive debut. He scored. He had three chances. Obviously going to be an astute signing. He's a very good player. Yeah, he was impressive. I'm not sure what more you could have asked for on his debut.
Rory, that's the sort of insight you get on this podcast. Do you, Rory, think he could take one of those front three spots?
Not immediately, but I think the idea is clearly that he's 23. Mane, Firmino and Salah are all 28 or older, which, as we are told constantly, is now too old. And if you have footballers who are 28, you have to be thinking immediately about their kind of impending death. That's very important. So I think the plan would be long term that he'd probably slot in for one of them. He's two-footed, Jota, and play through the middle, left or right. So it would be any of them. But I suspect this season they'll have to rotate so much, they'll all have to rotate so much, because there's just so many games that it won't be necessarily that he takes the place of one of the front three, but he plays quite a lot anyway.
Jake says, is Salah the last decade's greediest Premier League player? His interception of the pass to Jota to rob him of a chance of a debut goal was glorious. I can't think of that many. I always think that Harry Kane, and it sounds ridiculous after he got the most assists of any Premier League player in a game, but occasionally like puts a bit too much weight on a pass out to the left so that he can get in the middle to score a goal. But does anyone have a better example that doesn't go against all evidence of the last few weeks?
Well, I think Salah is definitely a selfish player. And towards the end of last season, he was, you know, taking ridiculous shots, clearly trying to win the Golden Boot. And that was fine because Liverpool had won the league and it didn't matter. But you know, when you are taking the ball off the toe of your own teammate before the game has been, you know, put to bed, that's not a great look.
Again, from the perspective of being there, and whilst generally agreeing absolutely with the thesis that Salah is greedy, and actually the word greedy isn't used nearly enough anymore. You don't get players who are described as greedy, but Salah is quite a greedy player. I just think it was Jota's fault. I think Jota didn't call for it, and I suspect it was one of those things where, because Jota's a new signing, he didn't quite feel like empowered to say, get out of the way, Mo, I want to hit it. And I suspect that was the confusion. So I'd be more inclined to blame a slight breakdown in communication. But yes, Salah is greedy. Was Hazard quite greedy?
I can't remember. It's so long ago.
Just forgotten.
He played football,
plays in
wasn't
Spain.
It? At least,
mad.
Yeah, that's so far away, Rory.
Farmers League.
There is one goal. I'm sure Ronaldo scores a goal where somebody pokes it in on the line and is offside. And it's
Nani.
Great. Is that right? It's Nani. And Ronaldo's displeased about the whole situation. Ben says, why can't Hector Bellerin take a throw in properly? My 8-year-old can. Apparently, Jack points out that it went back to Bellerin after his second foul throw. And he said, I've been doing it that way my whole life, which perhaps is a sign that referees don't give as many foul throws as they should. But at that level, you know, when you're on that much money, Jordan, every week, you've got to be able to take a throw in.
I felt for years, Max, if I was a football manager, there are two things in which I would enforce fines for. One, if the team concedes in the first 5 minutes of a game, it's unacceptable for me. If you concede in the first 5 minutes, you're not ready. I'm not having it. And the other thing is foul throws. How do you foul throw at that level? I mean, you don't see foul throws at kids' level, but to do it twice in a game, that's got to be a heavy fine. It's embarrassing. So embarrassing.
Can I add two more fines?
Go for it.
Corners that don't beat the first man. Unacceptable. And players who wrongly claim corners/goal kicks when they know the ball hit them last.
I do that.
Yeah, I know you do, Matt. I have to put with you. It's wrong. It's morally wrong.
Can I challenge those two? So the first one, that I agree, it's frustrating to be a professional football player in the Premier League and not be the first man from a corner. My only kind of comeback would be sometimes it can be a tactic to try and whip the ball in the near post. And
yeah,
you can be
right,
aiming,
yeah.
Do you know what
in,
I mean? So
in that circumstance, that's okay. If you're, to be fair, Arsenal tried that last night. There were two of them last night that I think Robertson cleared both of them from the near post. And it was very obvious that Arsenal had clearly worked out that there's some sort of weakness in Liverpool's near post marking or whatever. So if you're aiming for there, maybe. If you're not aiming for there, and they all know where they're aiming, then it's not acceptable.
Did you enjoy Jurgen Klopp versus Roy Keane, Barry? Who won?
No, not particularly. It was a pretty banal exchange, which has been turned into this massive shitstorm that it really wasn't. I think Roy Keane made a comment. Jurgen Klopp didn't quite hear it properly. There was a slight misunderstanding. and that was about it. But because Roy Keane was involved, it's been whipped into this massive controversy, which it really isn't.
Yeah. Well, let's move on then. Okay, why
well,
not?
Other people are welcome. Other opinions are available. I seem to be in a minority.
No, I agree.
Roy Keane says anything even remotely contentious, or as was the case last night, is pulled up on it by Jurgen Klopp, it's you know, a massive deal is made of it because it's Roy Keane. If that had been Danny Mills or, you know, name your pundit, that wouldn't have happened. I thought it was pretty banal.
There was this like whisper that went around the press box that there'd been some sort of contretemps between Klopp and Keane, and Sky replayed the audio on the monitors, kind of replayed the Sky audio, and then I was like, well, that doesn't sound like that much of a fracas. Like there must be more that I've not heard. So I went on the internet and pulled up a sort of a British newspaper's, not the Guardian's, version of it. And it was just a quote, so I thought, right, obviously haven't missed anything. And basically the headline was like, Klopp clashes with Keane or whatever. And then at the bottom it said, this is a breaking news story. There will be more to follow. We will keep you updated. You think, this is, the story here is man says thing about other man. Other man says, no, you've misunderstood. First man says, all right, sorry. And that's it. There is no kind of part two to this story. It just, it felt like a total storm in a teacup.
Fulham 0, Aston Villa 3. And to do this, let's bring in Archie Rintutt, who will do the Bundesliga stuff after he's taken off his Fulham hat. And Archie, how are you?
Not great.
Yeah, Fulham
really
were,
not great.
Fulham were really rubbish, weren't they? The last time, by the way, a 5:45 p.m. kickoff was Blackburn Everton, New Year's Day 1997. I tweeted out yesterday, this is the first time ever that a Premier League game has been on at the same time that Neighbours is on the TV. I made it up, but it got a lot of traction. It feels to me, Archie, like Fulham being bad is a bigger story than Villa being good. Obviously, there were two teams on the pitch, but let's do Fulham first, shall we? What did you make of that?
Do you remember when Fulham used to be a mid-table side in the Premier League that you could rely on? Oh, those were the days. These days are very much behind us now, because I remember saying to you after the playoff final that I think we're going to get more points than last time. I really struggle to see us now getting more points than Derby did in 2008, because the way that we are playing right now and the squad that is there is just not good enough, and it runs much deeper than the performance last night. I mean, the fact that Dennis Adoy was given a new contract in the last few weeks tells you just how big a disparity there is between how players are viewed at the club and the reality of the football that we're trying to play. But it's much bigger than Scott Parker. I've spoken about the CEO, Alistair McIntosh, before. I think that Tony Khan's work on recruitment has not been good enough as well. So, I think it's important to look at the big picture here and see that this is going to be the third Premier League clown car season that we've had in the last 6-7 years. And there are big reasons up top for that, because the mentality that I encountered when I was on the supporters trust at the club was always, it's not my problem, and just to shift it along. And there was no real responsibility being taken. And eventually I think that seeps down to all levels of the club.
Tony Khan tweeted last night, I apologise to Fulham supporters for our performance tonight. We've looked to add centre-back since Wembley. I'm sorry we haven't yet, as two got COVID and we lost a free transfer we thought was close and had other issues with a fourth centre-back. I promise players in and better efforts from this squad. Rory, is that a good thing to do? I mean, I sort of think for Tim Ream it's a sad tweet, isn't it?
You seem to be really worried about Tim Ream. Why are you upset about Tim Ream?
I'm now worried about Tim Ream and Dennis Adoy. I didn't know it was all Dennis Adoy's fault.
It felt a little bit like Archie was singling Dennis Adoy out there, which is unfair. No, I think it's a great thing if you're a Premier League team with players to shift. That is a brilliant thing. That's just what you want to see. The billionaire owner of another club saying, we're crap and we need more footballers. It's not brilliant. I suppose it... Well, I mean, I'll bow to Archie as a fan, but I guess that the silver lining is maybe that there's evidence that he's genuinely kind of invested in the success and that he wants it to change. But it's not, it doesn't make a huge amount of sense other than displaying passion, which, as we all know, is the most important thing in football.
We spent a lot of money on players who are not that good. And I'm not just looking at the obvious Jean-Michel Seri, who is still on the club's books, but also Anthony Knockaert, Bobby Reid, Ivan Cavallero cost nearly combined 30 million. And I think that no other club would probably have paid that much for players who don't really look like they're able to cut it at Premier League level. And it's a bit of a joke with some friends of mine that I always single out Odoi. So yeah, probably on that front. But Tim Ream, it's really sad because these players were so good under Slavisa Jokanovic, and now they're just kind of sad, hollow shells of themselves. And,
but the thing is, yeah, that like Cavallero is not a bad footballer, and that's kind of true throughout. Like Tom Cairney's a good player, and there are, Hector's obviously good in the Championship. It's a bit, it might be a step too far for Michael Hector, but you know, there's talent there. It's just the thing with Fulham is it just seems so. I have no idea what the plan is, what the idea behind the squad is, and I think that's something that you can now really tell the teams that have got, like, there is someone behind the scenes going, like, our idea is this. And the teams are just like, well, he's quite a good footballer and he's quite a good footballer, and we'll throw them all together and we'll see what happens.
And that's exactly the problem that Fulham have. It's just like been trying to muddle through for seasons, and the club have always said to the fans, no, trust us, we know what we're doing. And have just been consistently caught in this loop of, we're doing what looks right instead of doing what is actually right, and just continually throwing lots and lots of money at it. And you end up with this. Even the situation with the goalkeeper, I really don't get. Marek Rodak had an outstanding season last year. And you'd think that, particularly the way that the defence have started, you'd want to keep at least that dynamic between the centre-backs and the goalkeeper the same. And we bring in Alphonse Areola, who has not looked any better than Marek Rodak would have in the games against Leeds and Aston Villa now. And you just wonder, what is the point? Because Rodak is a young goalkeeper we have who has room to develop and I think proved himself as one of the best in the Championship. It's just difficult to follow the logic.
Let's say you're definitely going to get relegated, Archie. Would you, as a kind of badge of honour, like to get fewer points than Derby? Because but if you've read Fever Pitch, right, and you know, Nick Hornby talks about that Cambridge United season where they just didn't win and they never won, and eventually they won a game against Newcastle who had Chris Waddle and I think Beardsley was playing and those kind of players. And actually, it's a kind of badge of honour. And in years to come, you'll look back at this terrible season where you weren't allowed to go to the ground and you lost every single week. And it was just so, in the long term, it might be better than getting 24 points.
I'll tell you what, for the moment we had against Brentford, I'll still take this season. And that, I think, was always going to be the trade-off, because I knew at the time that Brentford were a better-run football club than us, which was already painful enough. But to know that we effectively shithoused the playoff final, I can still live off that. I don't want to be worse than Derby, no. You know, doing a Fulham is already kind of gone into footballing parlance in a way that is, you know, it's like, ugh. It's just a little bit painful. So, no, I'm not accepting your deal there.
Jordan, can somebody say something about Aston Villa before Villa fans get furious with us? John says, any chance you can dedicate the full hour to John McGinn? He was really good. That frees up Grealish. They've won 2 out of 2. They gave Jacob Ramsey a game, as Duncan Alexander tweets, the first player younger than celebrity Big Brother to play for Villa in the Premier League. You know, it was a great night for them.
Well, my question was going to be, I can refer it to Aston Villa as well. I'm not so sure with Fulham and Villa, the bigger problem are the players. I think it's the managers. I'm not so sure that Fulham's manager and Aston Villa's managers are good enough to even galvanise their group of players to do well. I think Villa have got better players than Fulham. But I just wonder, is Scott Parker the bigger issue there? He's been lauded and bigged up quite a lot by a lot of people in the media. And I've got a question mark over how good he actually is and can be. But with Aston Villa, I think it was a great win for them. I think they took Martinez from Arsenal, which I think is arguably the signing of the summer. I think he made the difference in keeping them in the Premier League this season. But I just wonder if Dean Smith is good enough to, over the course of the season, amass enough points to keep them in the league. That's my big concern with both of those clubs, to be honest.
There you are, Dean. Two wins out of two, and that's the verdict you get. Rory.
Villa to me look like they've... I know what Jordan means, but like Villa to me look like they've... They're maybe sort of on to finish 14th this year. Like I think it'll be fairly painstaking progress to get into the top half. But I think if you know they've added Ollie Watkins, that gives them a bit of an edge. You've got, as Jordan says, you've got Martinez, who's an upgrade on Pepe Reina and Nyland and Tom Heaton when he's injured. So they look a little bit more solid, a little bit more settled. And then that's a good midfield. Douglas Luiz, Grealish, McGinn and Conor Hourihan is that's a genuinely good kind of mid-table midfield. So I think Villa will be fine, but kind of unspectacular. They'll finish in the Newcastle position.
Archie, stay where you are. We'll do the Bundesliga next. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Archie, while you're here, the Bundesliga, Bayern and Dortmund lose. That doesn't fit my lazy narrative.
Indeed. So Bayern got taken apart by the guy who was in charge of their second team last season and won the third division with them as well, Sebastian Hoeneß, who is the son of Dieter Hoeneß and the nephew of Uli Hoeneß, who was taken over at Hoffenheim this summer. And two out of two, his Hoffenheim side are now top of the league. They had I think with Bayern Munich's game plan, as we saw in the Champions League, it's very high risk. And there's a certain amount of time I think you can go until the team takes advantage of it. I think as much as Thomas Müller said there wasn't tiredness, I saw a certain amount of it in the Bayern performance the other day. And Hoffenheim came up with a game plan which was able to take advantage of those small chinks and in the Bayern armour. So they were very impressive. As for Dortmund, we saw this performance from them a lot during the first half of last season, except it's been levelled against them that this is deja vu. Losing 2-0 away at Augsburg is precisely the kind of reason why they don't win the title. But I'd say that about half of the team were not there in those situations last year. So they've caught this Dortmund disease of not really turning up in these games. But look, they had 80% of possession. They didn't move the ball quickly enough in the opposition final third. But it's difficult to see them overcoming this problem whilst Lucien Favre is coach. Lucien Favre brings a lot of good things, but I think that sometimes being able to change it up and be a little bit more variable is something that his side struggle to do.
Reading Jamie Jackson saying Man United might actually make a bid for Sancho, what do you reckon?
I think he'll still be staying at Dortmund come this time next week.
All right. Two sackings already as well. Seems quite early.
Prior to this, only four coaches in Bundesliga history had ever been sacked after the second match day, and then two go this weekend. So start with the slightly fruitier one, which is Achim Bayerlotzer leaving Mainz, a guy who I've always been told is like the nicest coach that you will meet. However, nice guys finish last, seemingly. And he is somebody who struggles to command a dressing room, to the point that when he tried to banish Adam Solai to the second team last week, the players went on strike on Wednesday and refused to train. So you go into the game against Stuttgart with that background, and they actually went 1-0 up, but then they threw in the towel in some pretty special fashion. I've never watched highlights before and thought, yeah, I can really see that the players are not playing for the coach here, just in terms of getting back. By the time it got to the fourth goal, half the team had given up. So that wasn't very surprising. And then David Wagner, that wasn't really very surprising either, because he's gone 18 games without a win. You think that he's had a lot of patience in both of his last managerial spells. Now, he went 14 games without a win as Huddersfield coach and managed and then was sacked. And now 18 games. I think he would have been sacked earlier had Schalke had the money to do it, but they're in big financial trouble. I think Wagner's downfall was ultimately down to him being a my way or the highway kind of guy, being too tactically rigid and having a group of players this season at the core of which you have four or five players that he didn't want there and sent out on loan last season. And now, because of their financial trouble, they come back. The likes of Ralph Fairman, Mark Oot, Nabil Bentaleb, remember him. And it's like, okay, guys, now you're going to play key roles in my side. And they're not having it.
Is
so,
there a an Allardyce Claxon in Germany? Who's the big Sam?
Well, Bruno Labbadia was that to some extent, but he's reshaped his image quite well. He's got the hair to job at the end of last season. I think the ultimate Allardyce Claxon here, and his nickname is the Fireman, is Peter Neururer, renowned mostly for his time at Bochum. He's got a fine moustache that he's very distinguishable by. However, he's not had a Bundesliga job in a while. So anytime you see his name being punted out on Twitter, you know it's mainly a joke, as like, no one could do that, could they? But yeah, no one quite has the Allardyce reputation of the pint of wine and all that.
Archie, listen, drown your sorrows on your water slide and we'll speak to you soon.
I've not moved in yet, but I have scouted it. I will. Thank you.
No worries. Archie been tucked there out in Germany. From Germany, let's go to Spain and say hello to Sid Lowe. Sid, Luis Suarez in an Atleti shirt. How did it look to you?
Well, he was very, very good indeed. I mean, it was one of those games that was sort of so good and it all happened so fast it ended up being funny. He came on as a sub in the 70th minute, played, what was it, 23 minutes, scored two goals, hit the post, provided an assist, created another clear chance, won a penalty, which was then taken off him again, and all in all played pretty well. And it's probably worth pointing out that he does come on with a score 3-0, so it's already done. But in the end, Atletico beat Granada 6-1.
Barcelona looking good as well, looking like they don't miss him. Or is it too early to say, Sid?
Yeah, of course it's too early to say. I mean, look, in theory at least, they shouldn't miss him, because in theory this is a decision that's been driven by a footballing shift, not driven purely by his age, but in part, and not driven purely by politics, but in part. And that there was a desire to move away from Suarez, who was seen as part of their problem in footballing terms. Whether or not that's right, of course, is a different debate. And they've shifted formations, they're shifting approach, and they played pretty well. It's quite difficult to judge how good Barca were, because I must admit, in the first half, I thought they were brilliant. But they were playing against a Villarreal team that was so pitiful, which surprised us, by the way, because they shouldn't be this bad. But they were so pitiful that it's difficult to fully grasp the context within which we should be judging this game.
When I'm on my weekly Zoom with my real friends, we do a sort of happiness percentage tally just to see how we're all feeling in these strange times. Where's Messi on the happinessometer at the moment?
It's very difficult to know. I was telling you the other day, wasn't I, about how we kind of analysed and overanalyzed the handshake with Koeman. Of course, we then got a glimpse of how unhappy he was when Suarez left and he put out a message on Instagram saying, you know, I'm going to miss you. It's going to be very sad not seeing you every day. I've kind of got into my head that you weren't going to be here, but I walked into training today and you weren't there and the penny really dropped. And so there was a kind of a real melancholy and an incredibly open and emotional expression of their, I mean, and he uses the word, of their love for each other and you know, how close they were. But to kind of hone in on how Messi feels now, quite apart from the sadness of missing Suarez, at the end of this message, he said, you know, you deserve to leave Barcelona like what you are, one of the greatest players in the club's history, not be kicked out the way they did. But right now, the way things are, nothing surprises me. So it's fair to say that Messi's certainly not going to go quietly this season. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see how he handles this entire season. And the day after, Koeman was asked about this in his pre-match press conference before the first game of the season for Barca. And he said, well, it's normal that you'll be a bit sad when your friend leaves. But apart from that, Messi's fine. As if, of course, that was the only issue Messi has with Barcelona right now.
And what about Real? Ramos to the rescue again. It's incredible how he's still so pivotal. You say you can't imagine when we're talking about with Messi go, and could you imagine him in another shirt? You can't imagine Real Madrid without Sergio Ramos.
Yeah, and you're right. And it's curious because... Yeah, Ramos has been there for a very long time. There have been times, genuinely, when you've watched him play and thought, he's not that good. But Ramos has this incredible ability to be good when it really matters. You know, to come good from the spring onwards, to be very good from the kind of quarterfinal stage of the Champions League onwards. And his, what do you call this in English? The Spanish describe it as kind of ascendancy. His ascendancy over the other players, his ability to kind of lead and kind of cajole and condition everyone else is extraordinary. Also, he scores at weekend a penalty, which he does Panenka again. I'd be willing to bet there is no one on the planet who's performed more Panenka penalties in his career than Sergio Ramos. To the extent that you know, if you're a goalkeeper now, you've genuinely got at least a 50% chance if you just stand still, I think.
And finally, Sid, how happy are you to see Rory Smith in what some people would say is his rightful place?
What do you mean, his living room? Is that his living room, or is this my
attic office? It's not yet being decorated.
Oh well, I can send you some pictures if you like.
You've got a lot of pictures. Have you got like a regular framer?
No, these are all from IKEA. I've got a whole load of pictures which unfortunately are not standard size.
So you and your non-standard pictures.
I need to get a framer because that costs quite a lot of money, a proper framer, which is terrible.
Framing is prohibitively expensive.
But it's a skill.
It's amazing.
It's a skill. Yeah, it's a genuine craft, proper framing. You're paying for quality
there. Right.
And it says a lot about you, said that you haven't. You've just gone to IKEA.
Yeah, well, no. More to the point, it says that I had a couple of pictures in frames which I had done. Made to measure, which I had in frames just sitting on the floor for about 2 years because I don't trust myself to hammer a nail into a wall straight. And then when I tried to do it, I realised why I don't trust myself to hammer a nail into a wall straight, because I'm not very good at it.
That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll talk about the Premier League meeting to discuss fans coming back into stadiums and helping the EFL, and round up any other business too. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the Premier League clubs and shareholders are going to meet today to discuss the government's decision to delay fans being allowed to return to stadiums. That is one of the main points. The other is how the Premier League are going to help the EFL. Jordan, is it worth speculating what they'll come up with?
Well, just first of all, hearing Rory and Sid there talking about framing and the craft of it is as Guardian as it gets. I love it. I really, really love that. It's a really important meeting. There's been a lot of pressure and attention on the Premier League to be this kind of Superman to come to the rescue and save English football. And because of the money that the Premier League generates, you kind of understand why. But I think what the Premier League will put forward is the fact that as much as the Premier League does have huge wealth, like any other business or industry, they have to look after themselves. We're going into times whereby, I don't care how rich you are, unless you're Amazon or, you know, or that kind of level, everyone's going to be losing money here. So whilst I think the Premier League will decide that they do feel some responsibility to help out the lower leagues, they'll also put forward the argument that we have to look after and try and preserve ourselves. Now, that might be greeted with the smallest violin in the world, but I think the Premier League have done a really good job of trying to amalgamate themselves as part of this. We have to fix this problem rather than we have to help the rest of English football. I'm on my way to Charlton after this recording now to do some work down there and some interviews about how it's going to affect clubs like Charlton. But I think what comes out of this meeting will be very, very important. The Premier League and how they position themselves in, can they help and how much will they help, I think is what I'm most interested to see.
Do you think, Rory, that we perhaps, like, we got some criticism yesterday for spending so much time talking about handballs and not talking about the crisis of the EFL. Are we taking it seriously enough?
I know what you mean. Probably not. And I think, I wonder if it's partly because, like, the Big Six in particular, but the Premier League in general kind of just consume so much oxygen that it's really hard for any other subject to get traction. And partly because it's a little bit kind of dry and financial, but also partly because I don't know whether we're, as a, like a species, particularly good at kind of comprehending impending disaster. I don't think many people think, well, you know, 20 clubs might go to the wall. I don't think people can kind of conceptualise what that looks like or understand how that comes about, especially at a time when you see lots of money being spent at the transfer market and you think, well, there's loads of money in football, I'm sure someone will do something. But if anything, I think what this has kind of shown is that there isn't quite as much money in football as we think there is, that a lot of it is, it sort of sloshes around from place to place without ever really sticking. Was it Brian Clough called it prune juice, that money in football goes straight through you, which is not particularly sort of, it's quite an evocative image. It's maybe not one you want to think about in the context of Brian Clough. But if you think about kind of most clubs' balance sheets and most clubs' profit and loss ledgers and stuff, they're not sitting on vast sums of money. The owners are a different thing, but the clubs themselves don't have huge cash reserves. They're not. There's a lot of kind of, what struck me during the first wave of the pandemic was how much football's wealth is kind of a, it's like a smoke and mirrors trick. It's it's the display of wealth, the kind of the front room that's full of, you know, that's full of gadgets, but you don't have any curtains. And it's, there's an element of trickery about it, and that they spend the money in the transfer market, but then, you know, they're amortizing it on the contract, on the books, which we're all told is this brilliant kind of, well, this is how accountancy works. But if you think about it, it's just a trick. It's just a trick to make you think that you spent less money than you have. It's, you would not get away with that with the individual, with the tax man. They wouldn't be like, oh yeah, that's fine. You can amortize your TV over the amount of time that you use it. That's fine. But that's, there's a lot of kind of smoke and mirrors with the way that football's finances work. And I'm not sure that the kind of the Premier League has to bail everybody out works. So I don't quite understand where people think that the Premier League is going to magic this money from. They don't have hundreds of millions of pounds spare. They can help a bit, and they should. They have a moral duty to help a bit. But they don't have hundreds of millions spare to sustain English football indefinitely. They just don't. The government will have to contribute as well.
But the government seem hell-bent on not contributing. They seem to have Oliver Dowden, the secretary for whose umbrella covers football, and his undersecretary Nigel Huddleston have both said it's up to the Premier League to help out. I mean, there's a lot of questions you have to ask here. Are the Premier League morally bound to help out? Yes, I think so. Do all the clubs in the pyramid deserve help? Not necessarily. Some of them are really badly run and would have possibly have gone to the wall anyway, whether COVID happened or not. You've clubs like Exeter City in League Two. They're fan-owned. They have cash reserves because they're sold good players like Ethan Ampadu, and they're getting, there's a $4 million from Ollie Watkins, his move to Villa. Do they need help? Possibly not. And that all this talk of a bailout by the Premier League seems to be, the suggestion seems to be that they just hand over this big wadge of cash. That's not going to happen. It will almost certainly be a loan if they contribute, a low-interest loan. It will almost certainly come with stipulations. One of the stipulations possibly being, we will hand over this money, but we will insist on there being no relegation at the end of this season. They could insist on a salary cap for Championship clubs, which would help them pull up the ladder and cement their own position as the top teams in the country. Is that a good thing? No. But clubs, some clubs are so desperate they will probably agree to anything if it helps keep them afloat, and you can't really blame them for doing that.
Is there not a weirdness too that you see Dowden and Huddleston say the Premier League has to help out, and this is a point Sean Dyche made, and I think it was sort of willfully misinterpreted, just as it seems to have been decided on social media that sort of Dyche is the football manifestation of Brexit, which I don't think is necessarily true. Dyche kind of made the point that you're not asking, he used hedge funds as an example, maybe that's not the best example, you're not asking like really successful financial firms to bail out less successful financial firms. That's not how 2008 worked, and it's not what anyone's going to expect in that sector now. Barry mentions Amazon. Like, no one's saying, well, look, local bookshops are completely banjacks, the Waterstones are banjacks, we should get Amazon to bail them out. And it is weird to me that the government are like, well, no, the successful bit of this industry has to help the less successful bit of this industry, which has a logic to it, but does only seem to apply to football. It doesn't even apply to other sports. It's a really strange position for the government to take.
But the thing is, Rory, football teams need other football teams to survive. This has been raised in Scotland in particular, where there is a very real threat that every club in Scotland, apart from Celtic and Rangers, could go to the wall. So the suggestion being that Celtic and Rangers Celtic in particular have a duty of care to help out other clubs, because if they don't, they will have no league to play in.
I think there's two things as well. I've done some number crunching, and I reckon between now and Christmas, unless somebody does something drastic in terms of financial help, 10 clubs go. I could easily see between now and Christmas, 10 clubs just literally being wiped out. And that's a brutal probability that I can foresee happening. And the second thing is, I think all the teams below the Premier League, once we come through this, have to really have a system and a structure that looks at how they spend their money. Because the dream for all those clubs is to get to the Premier League. We're going to spend until we get to the promised land. And Burnley did it, Bournemouth did it, Brighton did it, Huddersfield did it. We can all do it. But at what cost? And I think you have to make that kind of, I don't want to cap anybody's ambition, but at some point those clubs will have to restructure to decide, look, are we going to outspend what we can afford to get to the Premier League? Or are we going to work on a model that actually gives us sustainability, whereby, okay, we can't buy the players and the salaries that get us to the Premier League, but we're at least sustainable for the next 5-10 years.
We will obviously discuss what the Premier League say on Thursday. Also on Thursday, we'll look at the Carabao Cup game. Spurs playing Chelsea tonight. They've got a game on Thursday as well. So I'm interested to see what type of sides Jose puts out this evening. Brighton United, Everton, West Ham, Burnley, Man City. We'll finish on this from Josh, who says, following on from always hearing the medieval knight Serge Aurier whenever Serge Aurier is mentioned, I cannot help fail to hear I'm Eric Laporte whenever Barry says I'm Eric Laporte. Maybe he's just called Eric and someone misheard. Thank you, Josh. Appreciate that. And that'll do for today's podcast. Barry, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Rory.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Jordan.
Anytime.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.